Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Sherritt International Corporation Fourth Quarter 2015 Results Release Conference Call and Webcast. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode, and following the presentation, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If anyone has any difficulties hearing the conference, please press star followed by zero for operator assistance at any time. I would like to remind everyone that this conference call is being recorded today, Thursday, February 11th, 2016, at 10:00 A.M. Eastern Time. I will now turn the conference over to Ms. Flora Wood, Director, Investor Relations. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Angelique, and thank you, everybody, for dialing in to our fourth quarter and year-end call. With me in the room, I have David Pathe, President and CEO, Dean Chambers, CFO, and Steve Wood, COO, all of whom will be speaking. The presentation, MD&A, and financials are all available on our website, with the MD&A and financials to be on SEDAR shortly. We do have forward-looking statements that apply, and they're on the presentation on the slide two. With that, I'll turn over to Dave Pathe.
All right. Thank you, Flora, and good morning, everyone. Oh, interesting times in our industry. Before we take your questions this morning, as we've done the last few quarters, I'm going to ask Steve Wood to comment for a few moments on some operational highlights, and we'll have Dean speak to you about a few financial matters. Just before we get to that, there are a few things I wanted to touch on as well. Starting into our slides there on page four, I guess we're up to already. Just a few operational highlights off the top. You know, we had good success in both of our nickel operations this year, both with production up over 2014 and significant progress lowering net direct cash cost. You see that both in our Moa and Abitibi joint ventures. Q4 numbers, $290 in Moa and $407 at Abitibi, are both trending in the direction that we've been very pleased with over the last few quarters. That $290 number in particular is a very solid number from our perspective. We did have a bit of tailwind in the fourth quarter from a good fertilizer, seasonal fertilizer credit, but we are still generally pleased with the direction we're going in a cost perspective. Over the page in oil and gas, our oil and gas and power businesses continue in a depressed commodity price environment to show strong free cash flow, particularly our power business. We saw significant cash flow out of our power business, both in the form of EBITDA and principal and interest repayments on the finance loans that financed the construction of our most recent phase of development in the power business a couple of years ago. Most importantly, from a liquidity perspective, we've had maintained our strong liquidity position. Cash is actually up at year-end over Q3. That is driven primarily by drawing on our credit facilities. However, even normalizing for that, our cash position from Q3 was only down by $5 million or $6 million and down about $100 million for the year. Out of that cash, we did fund almost $150 million in capital expenditures over the course of 2015, as well as $106 million of contributions to the Abitibi joint venture. I'm going to talk a bit more about Abitibi in a moment, but just over the page on page six, I did want to just put the progress we've made in the last few quarters on and our net direct cash cost in both our nickel operations into some context for you. On that slide, you can see our NDCC at our two operations quarter by quarter, and the downward trend in both those numbers is readily apparent from the lines there. The dotted line you see across the middle is the from Wood Mackenzie's, their 50th percentile from a net direct cash cost perspective. That has trended down over the course of the last year as well, certainly aided by cheaper input commodities and cheaper fuel oil. But the reductions that we've been able to achieve in our net direct cash costs at both of our nickel operations have significantly outpaced the downward trend in the industry generally. Putting our operations in context now on page seven, you can see that's the industry cost curve from top to bottom in terms of the cost of global nickel production. Moa actually slipped into the top quartile of low-cost producers in the fourth quarter, and Abitibi trended down solidly into the second quarter. So both of our operations are now well below average of the net direct cash cost in our industry, And you can take from that curve as well that certainly spot nickel prices, 50, 60, 70% of global nickel production continues to be underwater on a cash margin basis, never mind sustaining capital costs or debt servicing costs. We continue to believe that's not a situation that is long-term sustainable, and we continue to be focused on moving our operations down in towards that top quartile of low-cost producers. Over on page 8, I want to pause and just talk about a few things on this page. What you see here is not a new chart for us. A number of you will recognize this and have seen it before. This visual here kind of maps out the cash flow waterfall, if you want to call it that, out of Mbatovi. I want to just pause here and talk for a few moments on the capital structure of Mbatovi generally and in the context of our decision this month or this quarter to hold up our funding of future cash calls to Mbatovi at the moment. There's been, still some misunderstanding of the complexities of the capital structure here as well and the way those partner loans work, and so I want to just spend a few moments on this. There are two rounds of loans that helped us fund our share of Mbatovi construction through 2008 through 2012, 2013. The first, as you're all aware, was the project financing in Mbatovi. That was a U.S. $2.1 billion project financing. At the time, it was the largest project financing in the world, and it was a big part of the funding of the construction of Mbatovi through 07, 08, 09, 10, 11. That project, as you're now aware, has been into its amortization schedule for some period of time, and until we achieved financial completion at the third quarter of last year, was subject to parental guarantees from all of the sponsors for the pro rata share relative to our equity holdings. So Sherritt had an $840 million parental guarantee out to cover our share of that indebtedness. It was covered by cross guarantees from our partners, but we were nonetheless on the hook for the parental guarantee as well. With the achievement of financial completion last year, which I think was probably the single greatest milestone we achieved in 2015, those parental guarantees fell away. In the third quarter, we had significant funding into Mbatovi to fund a debt service reserve account that was part of the conditions of achieving financial completion. And that debt service reserve account was swept by the lenders in December for the December principal and interest repayment. The amortization schedule for that loan now calls for around $240 to $250 million a year U.S. in principal and interest repayments that come due every June and December. And the reality is that now that the sole obligor for those principal and interest payments are the companies on the ground in Madagascar, the project at these nickel prices is not yet producing sufficient cash flow to be able to see a pathway forward to making that June principal and interest repayment. And as a result of that, having got achieved financial completion and having had the 45-day challenge period expire in the course of the fourth quarter, we are now into a process of a negotiation with the senior lenders under the Mbatovi financing regarding some potential alterations to that amortization schedule, given that Mbatovi this year will not have the cash flow to meet the amortization schedule as currently construed. For the last couple of years, the biggest demand on our balance sheet and from the sponsors generally contributions to Mbatovi has been that amortization schedule. But now with the achievement of financial completion, as I say, those financial guarantees falling away, it does open up the opportunity for a conversation with the lenders, and that's why financial completion was of such great significance to us last year. So that will unfold in the months ahead. The lenders have appointed a financial advisor. There have been some meetings already. There are more scheduled in the next couple months ahead, and I think you can look towards that June principal and interest payment as really what will create the urgency as the weeks unfold here towards getting some solution on that round of discussions. Moving further down the capital structure from there, then, you also have some familiarity with what we've referred to as our Mbatovi partner loans. Back in 2009, in the wake of the financial crisis, in order to get construction back on track, our partners agreed to lend us money on a non-recourse basis to fund our share of equity contributions to the project to fund the construction of Mbatovi. The deal at the time, which worked very well for Sherritt in the circumstances after the financial crisis, was that they would advance us the money. Those loans would have no recourse to the Sherritt top company balance sheet. and would be repayable solely from our future share of distributions from Mbatha-Vie once it was up and running. This is where I think there's still been some confusion even in the last few weeks and some suggestion that that cash could come off our balance sheet to fund some of the principal and interest on those loans. The reality is that that can't happen on, by their terms. They're repayable only from future distributions from the project. We've never paid any principal or interest on those loans and won't until the Mbatha-Vie starts to have cash available for distribution to its shareholders. And under the terms of those loans, if Mbatha-Vie never produces sufficient cash to repay those loans in their entirety, then they won't be repaid, and the only recourse is to the residual interest in the project at the end of the project life. It's those loans, however, now that really have the greatest impact on our decision not to to fund Mbatha-Vie at the moment. Certainly our focus is beyond liquidity, and the potential cash drains of Mbatha-Vie in 2016 was a significant factor, particularly in the absence of any clarity yet on what the arrangement will be with the senior lenders. However, those Mbatha-Vie loans, as they have now sit and now interest has accrued on those in the last few years, now create a significant disincentive for us to fund, even if we had ample liquidity available. The arrangements on those loans in terms of the sharing of our partner distributions, our future distributions, shares require us to send 70% of the future distributions from Mbatha-Vie to the partners against principal and interest on those loans, with the remaining 30% coming to us. With the loans now at the balance that they are and interest continuing to accrue on them and the low nickel price period that we've been enduring now for some period of time, the reality is that over the life of the project, we now need a nickel price significantly higher than where we are today to see those loans repaid in any meaningful time period. So as we look at it from a present value perspective today, the cash flow that we're going to see in any meaningful time frame out of Mbatha-Vie is really limited to 30% of our distributions. So 30% of our 40%, we're only really going to see 12% of the cash flow out of Mbatha-Vie, despite being a 40% shareholder. And that is really what's behind our decision not to continue funding at a 40% rate. That, as we've worked through this issue with our partners in the last month or two, subsequent to financial completion, has really been what we've dubbed here our 40 for 12 issue. Regardless of where we are from a liquidity perspective, continuing to fund Mbatha-Vie at a 40% basis to really only see 12% of the returns on any reasonable time frame, given where nickel prices are at the moment, doesn't make sense from any rational capital allocation model. In a time of tight capital, at least if we, you know, 50 cents invested in our MOA joint venture gets us a return on 50 cents. A dollar spent in our oil business gets us a return on a dollar. Right now, an incremental 40 cents into Mbatha-Vie gets us the return on 12 cents, and that simply doesn't creates a significant disincentive to us. It's a prohibitive disincentive, really, from further funding and on the capital structure as it's currently construed. So that is the second round of conversations that is now taking place between us and our partners. It is complicated because of its interconnectedness with the previous discussions that we talked about with the lenders in terms of knowing what level of funding may still be required from the shareholders post some arrangement with the Mbatha-Vie lenders. And so I think this is going to be an iterative process over the weeks and months ahead here as we work through that and try to come back up to some arrangement that more accurately reflects our true economic interest in Mbatha-Vie. For the moment and the time being, the basis of our financial position today and our desire to maintain a strong liquidity position and that significant disincentive that the capital structure creates towards further funding at the time being, it has led us to the conclusion that we are no longer funding Mbatha-Vie in the present circumstances. I do want to reinforce briefly that it takes nothing away from our view on the quality of the asset. As an organization, we're tremendously proud of what we achieved at Mbatha-Vie in 2015, and the team are on the ground and our team in technologies have done a tremendous job in my view. I think it's no sense of hyperbole at all now to say that Mbatha-Vie is the most successful ramp-up of an HPAL nickel facility in the world. I think in 2015 we've proven from a technical and an economic perspective that it is the long life, low cost asset that we've long claimed it can be, and we would certainly be keen to continue to be involved in it for many years to come because it is right as we see it in our wheelhouse, but it clearly has to work for us from a financial perspective, and having spent 2015 de-risking and proving Embattavi from an operational perspective. A big task in 2016 is going to be fixing Embattavi from a capital structure perspective. There may well be more questions on that, and I'm happy to take those, but I did want to, that's really the bulk of what I wanted to cover here for you this morning, just to explain the rationale behind our decision to cease funding at Embattavi at the time being, and make sure that that relatively complicated Embattavi capital structure is understood in terms of the incentives that creates for us, particularly in this low nickel price environment. Just over the page, just on nickel markets generally, it goes without saying that 2015 was a terrible year in the nickel market, and the commodity world in general has got off to a pretty rough start in 2016. Long term, this graph shows projected nickel demand and supply in the years ahead. We continue to be long-term believers in nickel, particularly as we move our operations down to that bottom quartile or top quartile of low-cost producers in the world. I think you're going to continue to see a lot of volatility in 2016 as the world continues to sort itself out here, and that's going to take some time. But we're at the right end of the cost curve, and a lot of the industry is suffering significantly right now. That will still take some time to shift and sort out. But I do still believe that we are moving from a period of time of years here of nickel surpluses into potentially a period of time of significant period of time of nickel deficits. But the great volatility and uncertainty in the world right now is making it very difficult to understand or get any visibility as to when that is actually going to occur. From our perspective, we're in the nickel business for the next 30 years, and whether it's this quarter, next quarter, this year, next year is less important to us than having long life, low cost operations that we're confident in our ability to operate in. And that's where our focus has continued to be. For 2016, our priorities in a difficult commodity market really are not dramatically dissimilar to what they were in 2015. It's to continue to drive down costs and incrementally increase production in our nickel operations and try and look after the things that we have some control over. We are keen to continue to look to extend the life of our oil business in Cuba, and you'll see some capital allocated for drilling on our new block in Block 10 this year, and Steve will touch on that a little bit more. And of paramount importance is maintaining a strong balance sheet and a strong liquidity position. We were thinking about it was only 18 months ago that we did a debt deal to take out a series of debentures that were due to mature in 2015. We paid off about $400 million in debt, but we maintained a large cash position, and the questions we were getting then is why we were hanging on to so much cash. The reality is we hung on to a lot of cash because this is a cyclical business, and maintaining a strong liquidity position was important to us then, and it's of paramount importance to us now, and that's really the motivation behind the discussions that will be taking place in the weeks and months ahead here with our Embattavi lenders and our Embattavi partners. So that's where we stand at this point in time from my perspective. I'm going to ask Steve now to touch on a few operational highlights from the quarter and the year, and then we'll hear from Dean, and then we'll come back and take your questions. Steve?
Okay. Thank you, Dave, and good morning, everybody on the line. Before I get into the details of what's been happening in the operations and our outlook, I would like to cover a few points on safety. You've heard me speak in previous calls about the importance of safety, and we've had no fatalities in the fourth quarter. However, we did have three for the entire year, which is completely unacceptable and has caused us to reinvigorate our safety strategy, including adopting some enterprise-wide fatality prevention standards. On slide 11, I've got the MOA JV highlights. MOA had a good year, although Q4 nickel production was impacted by some power failures from a new national power plant. The refinery compensated by taking on third-party feeds. The feeds, though, were generally cobalt-rich compared to the MOA mixed sulfides that are normally feeding the plant. Our finished cobalt production was up around 19% in Q4 over the prior year, same quarter, as a result. I would like to say a few words about cobalt and the cobalt market outlook also. The quoted price for cobalt dropped from around $12 US to under $10 between November and December, and has since stabilized. A widely read Amnesty International report exposing artisanal mining of cobalt in the DRC using child labor has sparked concern around the source of cobalt being refined by customers. This should be good for Moa and Imbatovi, as we can demonstrate that the cobalt that we're mining has no source connected to the artisanal mining and child labor. We've done considerable work to reduce costs and more than offset the upward pressures going forward. We did have good fertilizer credits in Q4, which helped us with our NDCC, and we do have the upward pressures due to the seasonal nature of fertilizer credits, expectations of lower cobalt credits, and preparation costs for the new acid plant. The new acid plant is coming online in the second half and will considerably help us with our unit costs going forward. On slide 11, we cover off the Imbatovi JV highlights. Significant progress has been made in terms of reliability and stability around production. You can see that in the second half of the year, production was up over the first half and much more predictable. The year's guidance for 2016 is for a range of 48,000 to 50,000 tons, which is an improvement over last year and takes into account major maintenance required in Q3. The focus on reducing costs this year continues, and it's focused on increased efficiencies as we reduce maintenance downtime and build on our increased knowledge of the ore characteristics and our operating parameters as a result. On slide 13, I cover off the oil and gas highlights. Oil production has been declining on a quarterly basis as a result of natural reservoir declines and no new drilling as we get closer to the expiry of the original production sharing contracts. The guidance for 2016 is for a drop of more than 20% from where we were at the beginning of last year. However, our new drilling program is focused on Block 10, with the guidance you see in the slide not including any production from Block 10. We have the required permits to start drilling and expect to commence middle of this year. Slide 14 covers off the power highlights. Dave touched on this a bit. Power generation was up year over year with higher gas availability. Our net capacity factor has fluctuated between quarters and was at 70% in Q4 versus the 76% in Q3. And you can see the differences that makes on the chart. The guidance in 2016 is for slightly lower production based on gas availability forecast that we've gotten from the Cubans while a pipeline is being constructed. Some potential for actual availability to exceed forecast exists, as in previous years. Lower production and gas availability also impacts expected cash flow from interest and principal repayments on the CSA loan, which in 2015 generated approximately $72 million in interest and principal repayments. Going forward, we expect to receive something in the order of $9 million per quarter during 2016. Before returning to higher payments in 2017. Overall, it's a good production year, despite the commodity prices, with 2016 looking even better in metals production. This year will be an investment year in our energy business, with first drilling taking place mid-year. And so we've got positive outlooks in terms of operations. With that, I'll turn it over to Dean.
Thanks, Steve, and good morning. I have five slides today to assist in reviewing our financial results for the quarter and for the year. I will cover Imbatovi impairment and how it's reflected in our accounting, cash flow and liquidity, covenants in our credit facilities and our debentures, and a bit more detail on our sensitivities to our key commodities and the Canadian dollar. Today we disclose a net loss for the quarter of $1.8 billion, or almost $6 per share. This result was dramatically affected by the impairment of our interest in Imbatovi. Total adjustments in the quarter were $1.6 billion, resulting in an adjusted net loss of $114 million, or 39 cents per share, which is reasonably close to our estimate of analyst consensus of 36 cents per share. So let's talk a bit more about the Embattavi impairment on slide 16. It begins with an impairment of U.S. $2.4 billion on a 100% basis at the level of the Malagasy project companies. It's primarily impairment of property, plant, and equipment, but it also includes impairment of a deferred tax asset and inventory. The two most important management assumptions in the calculation of the recoverable amount are the long-term nickel price and the weighted average cost of capital. The long-term nickel price is the most significant assumption. We use the long-term nickel price assumption of U.S. $8.50 per pound. We reviewed a variety of long-term forecasts as well as historical prices to determine the nickel price assumption, and we calculated a weighted average cost of capital of 9%. The impairment taken on Sherritt statements is approximately 1.6 billion Canadian. 1.3 billion is our 40% of Embattavi's impairment in Canadian dollars. And approximately 300 million is from the impairment of our incremental carrying value, primarily related to mineral rights acquired through the acquisition of Dynatech in 2007. This slide shows you the impact on the key accounts in our financial statements. Embattavi is certified under Malagasy mining law for large operations. Under that law, there is a maximum allowed leverage. In order to remain in compliance, Embattavi needed to convert a certain amount of subordinated partner loans to equity to accommodate the impairment of assets. Our share of this conversion is $840 million. In essence, prior to impairment, our investment in an associate increased by $840 million with a corresponding decrease in a subordinated loan receivable. Taking this conversion into account, a $1.6 billion impairment and other adjustments related to the quarter results in a revised investment in associate balance of $757 million, a reduction of $810 million from the balance at September 30th. Our subordinated loan receivable balance has also been reduced to approximately $1.2 billion. We have implemented similar debt-to-equity conversions in the past to remain in compliance with the leverage regulations and to accommodate operating losses. The reduction in the carrying value of Embattavi's property, plant, and equipment will result in reduced depreciation going forward. We estimate our depreciation will be reduced by about U.S. $55 million per year, which, of course, will improve our share of earnings of an associate. Slide 17 shows the change in the combined adjusted operating cash flow for the fourth quarter compared to the third quarter. Adjusted operating cash flow captures cash provided by continuing operations, adjusted by the net change in non-cash working capital, to eliminate the timing differences and volatility associated with changes in working capital. You will see a big difference between our two metals operations. Moa benefited from strong fertilizer sales in the quarter due to the seasonality of that business. And Embattavi's cash flow from operations was negatively affected by lower production and lower realized prices compared to the third quarter, and it paid interest on the senior debt in December. Oil and gas and power both had lower adjusted operating cash flows with higher unit operating costs in both segments. And cash interest paid on the outstanding debentures is always highest in the second and the fourth quarters. The next slide, slide number 18, goes into some detail on the items impacting our cash and short-term investment balance from Q3 to Q4. We drew down $65 million on our credit facilities in the quarter, as described earlier. These facilities are essentially fully drawn. If we had not drawn on the facilities, our quarter-end cash balance would have been approximately $370 million, only $5 million less than the balance at the end of the third quarter. We benefited from a positive working capital change. We collected U.S. $36 million in oil and gas receivables, although overdue receivables are still almost U.S. $50 million compared to U.S. $54 million at the end of the third quarter. We had expected to collect more of the overdue receivables by year-end, and we continue to work with the Cubans on a repayment schedule that brings the receivables to current by year-end 2016. The cash paid for remediation at Obed and Coal Valley of $12 million is higher in the quarter relative to the full-year payments of $16 million. It relates to costs accumulated over the course of the year, but simply paid in the fourth quarter. There is a provision for additional payments of up to $19 million for such remediation. And, of course, in the quarter there was no funding of Mbatovi. Slide 19 provides a summary of the financial covenants in our bank credit facilities and our public debentures. We have two bank credit facilities. The syndicated revolving term credit facility has a maximum availability of $115 million, and it is secured by receivables and inventory. The line of credit is an unsecured facility with a maximum availability of $35 million. Both of these facilities have the same three covenants: a net financial debt to EBITDA covenant, a financial debt to equity covenant, and an EBITDA to interest covenant. I would note that these covenants cannot be directly calculated from our financial disclosure, as there are specific definitions and exclusions in the credit agreements. Just as an example, for the calculation of financial debt, the additional partner loans are excluded, but LCs and guarantees are included. As a result of the Mbatovi impairment, we breached the financial debt to equity covenant at year end, and we have received waivers from the lenders for that breach. Going forward, if current commodity prices persist, it is likely that we will breach other covenants. We will be working with our lenders to amend the terms of these facilities to deal with the current economic environment. I am optimistic that revised terms can be negotiated with the lenders of the secured revolving term facility, but new terms may be more difficult to negotiate in the case of the unsecured line of credit. With respect to our public debentures, there are a few financial ratios which can restrict the company's ability to make certain restricted payments or to incur additional indebtedness. We can make restricted payments if a total leverage ratio, which is total indebtedness divided by EBITDA, is below 3-1, or if there's room in one of our restricted payment baskets. Currently, the total leverage ratio is above 3-1, so any restricted payments would be based on room in any of those baskets. Examples of restricted payments are dividends and investments in joint ventures. Company may incur additional indebtedness as long as the consolidated coverage ratio remains in excess of 2-1. The consolidated coverage ratio is calculated as consolidated EBITDA divided by consolidated interest expense. Even if the coverage ratio falls below 2-1, the company can use room in substantial baskets to incur additional debt. Again, these financial ratios have very specific definitions contained in an indenture. None of these ratios have created a limitation on our business activities to date. My last slide, slide 20, summarizes our net earnings sensitivity to our key commodities and the Canadian dollar exchange rate compared to 2014. Our sensitivity to changes in nickel price in U.S. dollars has increased compared to last year due to increased nickel production and a weaker Canadian dollar. Our sensitivity to changes in the oil price in U.S. dollars increased due to the weaker Canadian dollar and lower Cuban tax rates. During 2015, the Canadian dollar weakened from a rate of 1.10 to purchase a U.S. dollar to a rate of 1.28. And our earnings sensitivity to changes in the Canadian dollar exchange rate is somewhat complicated. Since commodity prices are quoted in U.S. dollars, operating earnings are generally positively impacted by a weaker Canadian dollar, since the positive impact on revenue more than offsets the negative impact on U.S. dollar-denominated expenses. However, during a period of operating losses where U.S. dollar-denominated expenses exceed U.S. dollar-denominated revenue, the foreign exchange impact is negative, which was the case in 2015. The weaker Canadian dollar had a negative impact on operating earnings of approximately $90 million. In addition, many of our accounts receivables, accounts payable, loans receivable, and loans payable are denominated in U.S. dollars. Our U.S. dollar-denominated liabilities exceed our U.S.-based assets, resulting in a translation loss for the year of approximately $45 million. In summary, the weaker Canadian dollar had a negative impact on our earnings of approximately $135 million in 2015. That concludes my formal remarks, so I will turn the call over to the operator to open the line for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touchtone phone. If you're using a speakerphone, please pick up the handset before pressing any keys. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 at this time. And one moment, please, for your first question. Your first question will come from the line of Orest Wowkodaw of Scotiabank. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I guess I'd just like to start by congratulating you on making that hard decision in terms of funding, seizing the funding for Avadomi. I know that couldn't have been easy. My questions around that specifically are, I just want to, if you could please confirm my understanding, if you are unable to reach a resolution with the partners around the asset, could you just confirm what your residual liability would be around that asset? I believe it's just $130 million of recourse partner loans, and everything else would effectively drop away. But could you please confirm that understanding?
Hi, Orest, it's Dave. Thanks. Dean can add to this as well. But your understanding is essentially correct, right? There are two branches to those partner loans. One are the original loans that were in place from the time that the partnership was formed, and then a second set of partner loans that were the loans I was referring to that were done in 2009. The original partner loans are also only payable from future cash flow and distributions from the project. However, Sherritt is ultimately on the hook for those with full recourse at maturity in 2023, and the total balance of those is about $130 million. Even if those loans are accelerated in some circumstances, the acceleration is not a true acceleration that would remain payable in 2023. There is ultimate recourse to the Sherritt balance sheet for those loans, and we do ultimately have the ability to repay them in cash or equity. Other than that, the Avadomi partner loans, there were the 2009 that are now up to about $1.3 billion, $1.4 billion. Those are our full limited recourse to our interest in the project.
Okay, perfect. And in terms of balance sheet management, can you help me understand, so you fully drew your line of credit. Is it your intention to just sit on that cash, or could we see you either repay that line of credit or actually buy your 2018 bonds in the market at a pretty big discount? Just curious what the intention is to do with that cash balance now.
Over the course of the year, we'll manage that actively based on maintaining a strong cash position and how we fare against some of the covenants that Dean took you through there. But our goal with our credit facilities is to maintain and maximize our liquidity position. There isn't any present intention to use any of that liquidity to be buying back bonds.
Okay, thank you.
And your next question will come from the line of Greg Barnes of TD Securities. Please go ahead.
Dave, is there a mechanism where you can convert the partner loans to equity and dilute down to 12% so your economic interest matches your actual share interest?
Greg, there's no mechanism in the loan documentation as it's drafted. There's no sort of convert to equity proportion or provisions for the loan. That is certainly something that we would see as a desirable outcome. You know, when setting aside the partner loans and all the interest that is accrued on the partner loans, and if you just look at the capital structure of Avadomi, and where the where all the cash came from. You know, 28% of the total amount of equity in the project came off of our balance sheet, and right now we've only got effectively a 12% economic interest. And obviously you've seen up to this quarter and the write down that we and our partners have taken on the equity. And frankly, those loans, the partner loans, we look at them as effectively being 28% of the equity at the moment, given the payment provisions on them. And so that, as you, the thinking you're doing, I think gives you some sense of the potential tone of the conversation with the partners in the months ahead.
Right. And just going to Oris' question, it's not as simple as you turning your back and walking away from these partner loans and saying, we're not going to pay them, and that's it. I'm sure there would be repercussions if you tried to do that.
Well, ultimately, we would be we'd have a legal liability for that $129 million, and we would have that liability if regardless of what we do, our residual 12% doesn't produce sufficient cash flow to pay those loans off, or the 70% of any distributions we get to those loans doesn't cover them between now and 2023, regardless of how this plays out. And we'll see how that plays out. At the moment, the partnership is still a very constructive partnership. The arrangements we've put in place to see cash go into the project are at least sufficient to keep the project going, to allow time for the negotiations with the lenders to advance. The partners have waived any consequence of us or any suggestion of us being a defaulting shareholder under the shareholders agreement. Right now the partners are all working together towards a solution to this, both at the Abadavi lender level and the Abadavi partner level.
Okay. Dean, you said in your comments, despite the fact that you have tripped some of the covenants, it appears that there's no limitations on business activities at this point. Do you foresee a situation where there could be some limitations on your activities if nickel price stays at these levels?
Well, my comments reflected the ratios and the debentures, first of all, and they haven't restricted our ability to do anything. I think it could be that there's restrictions on our restricted payments, but I don't see that having a significant impact on us in the coming year or so. And we have the ability to incur additional indebtedness, but quite frankly, don't intend to do so, I don't think, at this moment. So I don't see any real negative implications for the ratios in the debentures. With respect to the credit facilities, you know, a breach of the covenant does give the right to the lenders to accelerate, and that's why we're continuing to work with our lenders on waivers and new terms.
So the restricted payments under the notes and indentures, does that include any payments you might have to make to MOA, for example?
It does include payments to MOA, but not necessarily under the loan arrangements between MOA and Sharon.
Okay. Thank you.
And once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any additional questions at this time, please press star 1 on your touchtone phone. And your next question will come from the line of Sasha Bokshava of BMO Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, operator. Dean, just wanted to follow up. Is there any risk that failure to fund Abadavi would trigger cross default on your corporate borrowings? And if so, what would be the time frame of that?
Becoming a defaulting shareholder, and, of course, our partners have waived that at this moment, and could create ultimately a cross default to our bank credit facilities, but we've received a waiver for that cross default.
And there would be no issue with the clause on your bond instruments that might call for an accelerated repayment?
If there is, if we become a defaulting shareholder under the shareholders agreement, and it cross defaults to the Abadavi partner loans, not the additional partner loans, so it's the smaller one, And if those lenders accelerate, and again, that really isn't a true accelerant. There isn't any real payment triggered by that because they can only be serviced by distributions from Embattavi. It could go to a cost default to under the indenture. Obviously, the remedy would be for Sherritt to repay that loan, which obviously wouldn't be in the interest of the bondholders. So we don't see that as a likely outcome.
Okay, thank you.
And ladies and gentlemen, there are no further questions at this time. I'd like to hand it back over to Ms. Wynn for closing remarks.
Okay, thanks a lot, Angelique, and thanks a lot to everyone who joined us. I know it's a busy day, a lot of reporting issuers today, and we'll be talking to you soon on our Q1 results.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect your line and have a great day.